This is Tiglath-Pileser IV
and Sennacherib II,
and this is edition number 21 of Musings of the Living. For this edition of Musings of the Living, we start off with a song called Bakery in Greece.
And then we have a reading of the short story The Weeping Buddha, and then a song by me called Cherub Angels.
After that, we have a book review on The Man Called Cash.
And then a reading of the Book of Wisdom by Sean Patterson.
We then discuss the Bible passage John 8:2-11, which centers this edition of Musings of the Living. And then, I read my second week of Tardude's Bible.
Following that, we have a movie recommendation on the movie Lady in the Water.
And then an interview with Edward Wright, and then a comic reading of Calvin and Hobbes by Kelsey Heinrichs.
To bring it all home, we have the musical spotlight on Brian Eno.
And finally, the outro song called Snooshlog. This is a song called Bakery in Greece.
I'm going to read a story called The Weeping Buddha. When I was a kid, there was a Weeping Buddha on my bedside table. My brother gave it to me. The Buddha's cross-legged and his head is in his hands. He cries because he feels your pain or something. At nighttime, your feelings leave you, and if you don't got someone to take it by the morning, when you stop dreaming, then it all comes back. That's what my brother told me. I didn't believe a word of it. Just like dream catchers, it was all superstition. But it was some way to remember my brother, so I kept it. My brother moved out when I was 6. Now whenever I'm sad or pissed off, like when I used to get into fights with my dad or something, I just sit with the Buddha and think about my brother. Sometimes I play my accordion to the Buddha. I play the accordion. I started when I was 11 or 12. Other than my brother, it's been the main thing in my life. I started writing songs when I was 13. They sucked, of course, but when I started high school, I had enough to make friends and impress girls. At 16, I had a steady band going with 3 other guys and a girl called The Other Suits. The Suits were doing pretty good when I was 17. We got to play at a few community clubs, and once we got a chance to play at an open stage. When I was 18, I told my parents me and the Suits wanted to try to get a tour and some record deals going. My dad wasn't too keen on that, though. "You've got to go to university, son. You will honestly make nothing of yourself if you don't," he had said. I said, "Don't be ridiculous, Dad. I don't need that crap," or something like that. Then I think he said, "Son, as long as you're under my roof, you will go to university." And all I said was okay. By 6 o'clock, I had thrown a bunch of clothes into a Sears bag and had my accordion and songbook packed. I laughed at my dad as he screamed at me and I walked out the door. Maybe because it was the last thing my dad said to me, but the only thing he said that hurt was, "Okay, fine, I'm gonna start cleaning out your room right now. Never come back here again. I don't want to ever see you again." And he didn't. I mean, the words didn't hurt then. Me and my dad talked shit all the time. I knew he didn't mean it, but later, when I thought about it, it did hurt, just a bit. Anyways, I met up with the suits and we practiced a bit. That night, my dad died. I don't know how. The doctor tried to explain it to me a million times, a million ways. At 3 a.m., I was sleeping over at a friend's house and I woke up suddenly. I'd forgotten my Buddha. In the morning, I got the news. The funeral was a week later. I didn't go home. I just went on practicing my music. I didn't cry or yell or punch holes in the wall or any of that crap. I didn't even think about it, not even at the funeral. I looked right at him and sat back down. The wake kind of pissed me off, though, so I thought, screw this, and went up to my room. My dad had actually started to clear out my room. My books were in boxes in the hall, and all the clothes had been bagged. But he had stopped. He was a lot like me most of the time. He started stuff, but stopped halfway through. If he hadn't died, it could have been weeks, maybe months, but I would have gone home. As I was walking into my room, my dad actually being dead was starting to hit me, and I felt a little better knowing what he said weren't meant his last words. When I got in my room, I saw my bookcase and dresser were empty and dragged to the middle of the room. I went around them. My bed had been moved too, but the Weeping Buddha was still there, sad as ever, and I sat down and cried. That was my story, The Weeping Buddha. This is my song, Cherub Angels.
Moonshine singing, my ears are ringing, I can hear the devil crying. Starlight kiss, and I'll be missed. Cherub angels sighing. Laundry basket demons being taken home. Naked madmen, hostess and alone. Saving up my sins in a piggy bank. Gonna blow them out of some old president's tank. Shelter wet in the underground. Sunglassed angels flying around. Death on the corner waiting for me. To cross the road I need a baby fee. Moonshine singing, my ears are ringing. I can hear the devil crying. Starlight kiss, I'll be missed. Cherub angel sighing.
Bathing in the shadows, the place of fear. That's where I forgot to hear. A cupboard hiding jalopy, soft moonlight. Take a blind man's glasses and you'll give him sight.
Angels on stairs singing the songs. Somehow they manage to smile along. Music and joy are the gifts they give. Teaching the rest of us how to live. Moonshine singing, my ears are ringing. I can hear the devil crying. Starlight kiss, and I'll be missed. Cherub angel sighing. Moonshine singing, my ears are ringing. I can hear the devil crying. Starlight kissed, and I'll be missed. Cherub angel sighing.
That was my song, Cherub Angels.
This is a response to the book The Man Called Cash by Steve Turner. Whilst listening to The Man Called Cash by Steve Turner, I was continually inspired by this guy called Johnny Cash. I was especially enamored when my friend Eric and I listened to him for a week as part of our musical spotlight program. The reason I love listening to Cash is because he has something to say and isn't shy about doing so. I think these lyrics from the song and album, The Man Comes Around, pretty much summarizes John's life in saying that we're all sinners, and how much value we ought to place in our faith.
Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down when the man comes around.
That sort of life doesn't come easy, though. He definitely earned it. He's referred to as the man who went to hell and came back alive to tell about it. If you've ever seen the great movie about his life, Walk the Line, you'll know what I mean. He was born into a redneck country family in the southern United States, with a raging, drunken father who would verbally beat John to a pulp for things that Johnny had no control over, like his brother getting killed. After he had a few painful years serving his country in the Air Force, he got into the music business. John and his musically illiterate friends, who worked in car repair shops, started recording, and pretty soon, the trio became a staple in the country music scene, touring with the likes of Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. After the initial venture into music, he got into drugs and made sure he was on a constant high. After he got off them, though, he married June Carter, who filled in the archetype of a mother for Johnny Cash by looking after him and giving him a reason to stay sober. He married June because of her ability to work in an industry dominated by men, and of course, her deep love for and rich history in music. The rest of John's life was trying to find meaning in his devoutly Christian faith. John found something in the area of commercial evangelical churches, and he got to become friends with some mega preachers throughout his life. He appealed to a wide range of people, from the young rebel to the fundamentalist Christian, which is why he got involved with the church. It was part of his lifelong desire to continually go to church, but he had trouble remaining faithful to this commitment. He left the church and got into drugs again in his 50s. After getting out of that stint, he continued to explore his musical tastes and found the rap and hard rock producer Rick Rubin. He helped Cash make his amazing American albums. The reason why Johnny Cash started such a revolution of staying true to what he believed was because he gave himself up to anyone who would listen to him, and could only do so because he was an outcast. He also kept in tune to what the youth of the times were into. I love the idea of a dying 70-year-old man doing a cover of a dark and gloomy industrial rock song, Hurt by Nine Inch Nails. He was open, to say the least. With Johnny Cash being an outsider, he sympathized with the other bold sinners in society. He played in large prisons multiple times. He said that the audiences there were grateful and would give all their energy to the concerts. I think the reason why Johnny Cash was compassionate to prisoners was because of how he had gone through hell and understood a bit of it. He never forgot his own sinful humanity because he had so explicitly experienced it numerous times himself. One of Cash's statements in the book was about how God had forgiven him, and so the least he could do was forgive himself. Cash's faith is the reason he appeals to me so much. He believed that it's all about growing strong roots in the soil of faith from the many seeds planted inside yourself, which is very solid. Johnny Cash understood the human condition quite well. One of his statements was when he was talking about when he had hit rock bottom. That's when he found God the most. In his mind, he was never alone. The cultural significance of Cash as a mythological figure resonated in the book loudly. It makes sense. Mythology, from Wikipedia. Stories that a particular culture believes to be true and that use supernatural events or characters to explain the nature of the universe and humanity. Cash's story was supernatural in the way that it showed how a life that was so entrenched in sin could also have so much compassion. In his later years, when he met Bono of U2, his first impressions of Cash were of meeting someone akin to Moses. He certainly left a rich legacy of following Christ.
A reading from the Book of Wisdom. Mastery of temper is high proof of intelligence. A quick temper makes folly worse than ever.
So far, you've heard the song Bakery in Greece,
and a reading of the short story The Weeping Buddha, as well as a song called Cherub Angels,
as well as a book review of The Man Called Cash.
Also, a reading of the Book of Wisdom by Sean Patterson.
You're about to hear a discussion on the Bible passage, John 8:2-11, which centers this edition of Musings of the Living, and then week 2 of Tard Reef Bible.
You will also hear a movie recommendation on the movie Lady in the Water.
And then an interview with Edward Wright, as well as a comic reading of Calvin and Hobbes by Kelsey Heinrichs.
And then a musical spotlight on Brian Eno.
Finally, you're going to hear the outro song called Snooshlog. This edition of Musings of the Living will be including a new section that aims to center the podcast more around the Bible. For this section, we'll choose a verse that we believe can help ground the edition at hand in Scripture and have a short discussion on how it applies to the given episode of Musings of the Living. For this edition, we've chosen John 8:2-11. This is a reading of it from the audio Bible, The Bible Experience.
At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him. Sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus,
"Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?"
They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them,
"Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her."
Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older one was first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her,
"Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?"
"No one, sir,"
she said. "Then neither do I condemn you,"
Jesus declared.
"Go now and leave your life of sin."
The life of Johnny Cash exemplifies this passage because his life was very explicitly sinful, as all of our lives are. But in the midst of that, he continued to serve God by being a musician and such, because he realized that he was forgiven, like the woman, like the adulterer in the passage.
Huh. That's kind of like, for the story I wrote, The Weeping Buddha, it's kind of like that, but it's condensed into one single mistake. So he makes a mistake in leaving home, and his dad dies, so he feels great repercussions. But when he returns to the Buddha, he realizes that he's forgiven anyway, that God is there anyway, like he's always there.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it's also for the song Cherub Angels, there's death and stuff, but there's still these angels that teach us to laugh and enjoy music, and God is there always. That's what it kind of means to me.
Hmm. So that's how the passage applies to this edition of Musings of the Living. Hope you enjoy the rest of it.
In my darkest hours, Father, when my troubles come, keep my feet from wandering, there from the I'll roam, lest I fall upon the wayside, lead me gently home. Oh, lead me gently home, Father, lead me gently home, Father, if I fall upon the wayside, lead me gently home.
It's Hard to Read the Bible, Week 3, Temples, Drunks, and Brooms. This week on Hard to Read the Bible, I started to understand more of the content of the Bible, specifically the Old Testament. I read Kings, Chronicles, Peter, and of course a Psalm and a bit of Samuel. I really enjoyed reading Peter again this week, because it's easier to understand than Kings and Chronicles. I also had a bunch of cool experiences outside of reading the Bible. On Chronicles and Kings this week, King Solomon gave temple building a try and did quite well. I don't really get why both King Solomon and King David both built temples, but I think it was because King Solomon was instructed by God to build a temple, just like his father David. You can tell by reading King Solomon's temple building chapters that something truly massive is happening. Everyone is instructed to gather stone and gold, and finally the ark. The whole process reminds me of the documentary Paperclips, in which a school continually is working on a momentous memoriam to the Holocaust, collecting one paperclip for each of the 6 million Jews that were killed in the Holocaust. Everyone in this small Tennessee town is put to small peasant work of counting paperclips or opening parcels of paperclips. And in King Solomon's temple building chapters, everyone around is doing their little part to make this testament to God. It's an amazing thing. After reading the Old Testament stuff through each day, I was glad to get onto reading Peter, which was a relief because of its straightforwardness. The book of Peter is like Paul's letter to the Galatians in that way, straight, to the point, and saying very solid stuff. There's tons of stuff to meditate on in the book of Peter, it's not even funny. Here's a passage that stood out for me from the first book, 4th chapter of Peter, about living for God. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be clear-minded and self-controlled so that you can pray. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each one should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. The first experience I had of the Bible outside of reading it was our storyteller and English teacher, Mark Cooley, telling us about a girl trying to please her parents in King Solomon's time. The story goes like this. The girl's parents think that she'll amount to nothing, so the girl goes to work building beautiful brooms by finding perfect sticks in the forest and corn stuff. After building the brooms with great care, she goes to the market to sell the brooms, and after a long while is completely unsuccessful. The girl gets fed up and starts screaming, "The brooms are for sale! The brooms are for sale!" and quite quickly sells them all. With the first time event of having 3 wondrous silver coins, the girl walks joyously home. On the way though, she passes through the densely magnificent waft of a bakery and promptly falls asleep on the baker's steps, making the baker very angry because of the lost business this stinky and dirty girl is causing. The baker demands that the girl must pay him for the lost business and the smell of his bread and pastries that she fell asleep on. The baker brings the scared girl to King Solomon to get justice done, not knowing how wise he truly is. King Solomon says to the baker that for the smell of your bread, you get the sound of the girl's coins. Apparently, there's a lot of stories surrounding Solomon. He sounds like a great king, in the Bible and in these stories. The second experience I had was a pretty wild one. I was on the bus and a drunken guy started talking to me. I couldn't hear most of what he was saying, but it was kind of freaky because he was looking me in the eye every time he said something and would constantly whisper things to me. He saw me reading the Bible and started asking if I went to church. He also started telling me about the Sabbath and how it was the day before Jesus was crucified. He said more stuff and I wish I could have understood him. Overall, it was quite weird in a scary and interesting way. To say it quite frankly, I love the commitment of reading the Bible each day, and I hope I'm getting something from it. We'll be right back.
This is a movie recommendation on a movie called Lady in the Water by M. Night Shyamalan. Lady in the Water is the third M. Night Shyamalan movie that has been nearly torn apart by critics. In my opinion, excepting Signs, although I liked that one as well, the director's films are just getting better and more sophisticated as we go along. Both The Village and Lady in the Water are deep and meaningful movies and are touching a spiritual core. As I followed all this director's movies, I'm having fun watching them evolve. One thing that has stayed consistently good, if not blossomed, is his storytelling ability, great cinematography, and scripts, and it doesn't hurt that he always gets great actors. The story he's telling in this one is the story of a being that has come to Earth from the Blue World to help ameliorate Earth. Paul Giamatti, the main character, is the janitor of a condo where an assortment of weird characters live. It turns out all the characters in the whole world fits into a fairy tale which almost becomes a Christic allegory about sacrifice and purpose. This is an honest look at how community emerges to help one person and ends up helping each other and discovering their own purposes. It's also his most comedic yet, with some greatly funny side characters and incredibly humorous moments. All in all, it's equal to The Village, less scary but funnier, and as imaginative and meaningful. A great movie about vocation, community, and sacrifice.
For a project in history class, I interviewed a senior at a local old folks' home.
What's your name?
Edward Ray.
What did you used to do as a kid?
My brother and I, we used to trap weasels and get gopher tails. We saved up a bit of money and we bought guitars.
Really?
Yeah, my brother and I used to play guitar together.
What kind of songs did you play?
Hey?
What kind of songs did you play?
Oh, well, guitars. I sold my guitar. I didn't want to play no more. Oh, we never was professional players like Atkinson or some of them fellas, but we had a lot of fun and my father played the accordion and my mother the mouth organ. We had a little band. We used to go and play at different parties and everything else. Then in 1940, the war came along in 39. So I was in the army in 41.
So you fought in World War II?
Yep. Well, yeah. You see, when I was in the army, we were going overseas. So they said, you get a form, fill it out. Have you ever had an accident? And of course I had. I had a serious accident when I was a boy, see?
Oh yeah.
Skull fracture.
How did that happen?
Oh, my cousin dropped a pole on my head.
A pole on your head?
Well, he didn't do it on purpose, he just, and I was only 5 years old.
Wow.
And that's why I didn't go overseas when they saw that. I'll never forget the war. Too many boys I knew never come home.
Yeah.
I was coming down the field with the tractor, and this fellow, his name was Clifford Collard, and he was walking down the road because he'd went to see his uncle across the river. See, there used to be a ferry down there, take you across. Yeah. So he jumped on the tractor and rode down the field with him. And he says, I'm going to join the army tomorrow, Edward. That was about 2 days after the war started. So, I never seen him again. He got killed in Italy, eh?
Yeah.
So, stories like that, they hurt. It's fine and dandy to say that's over. It's over, we know, but some things stick in your crop that you don't forget. And then when I got out of there, I got on the railroad. With the, it was all steam, and I shoveled lots of coal, but I liked the railroad, I always did.
Do you believe in God?
I'm not a, really a religious man, but still, I believe there's a controlling power someplace.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a controlling power up in the sky that controls, tries to control what's going on down on Earth. I believe that.
Edward's friend Henry then joined the interview.
Having lived your life, what's a really important thing that you've learned? That you would tell to young people today?
Railroading.
Like one important lesson.
Lesson?
Yeah.
Well, that was a lesson.
What did it teach you?
How to be a brakeman. How to work on the railroad. Same as
railroading was an interesting thing.
I thought it was interesting.
Oh, I'll see.
Huh? We had a lot of different things we learned there.
I'll put it this way. There's nothing else I would have sooner done.
Yeah.
With the small education I got now.
What are three principles you live your life by?
Well, I would say do what I done. I didn't steal. I didn't cheat. And I didn't go to work drunk. That's three things on when you hire on the railroad, they told you. Don't steal from the company. Don't go to work drunk. And don't use your pass illegally.
Don't chase too many women.
Yeah, for you.
That was you.
Not for me.
Oh, yeah, that was me. I forgot.
Oh, he's a ladies' man. He knows them all in here and everything.
Yeah. But I'm slipping badly.
So you were a ladies' man more in your, when you were younger?
Yeah, and he was a sincere, honest man. He never looked at other women. Good guy.
And we can both look now. We're both
single.
Yes,
that's right.
But we're both too old.
Yeah, all we can do is look.
That's all.
It's fun anyway.
Of course, that's right.
Yeah.
Calvin and Hobbes by Bill Watterson, read by Kelsey Heinrichs.
I've decided to be more of a people person and make more friends.
How come?
I don't get enough presents. From now on, I'm devoting myself to the cultivation of interpersonal relationships. After all, no man is an island. We all need love and the support of others. We're social beings with social needs. So as of today, my goal is to be one with my fellow man, to develop and foster these deep connections that... Just a second. Hey, Susie! Heads up! Pow! Help! I've changed my mind, Hobbs. People are scum.
I think true happiness can only be found in the wanton indulgences of animals.
The end.
Spotlight for this edition, we're covering Brian Eno, as requested by Linda Thiessen-Weeb of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Here's a song by him.
Music.
That was the song Evil Thoughts by Brian Eno, and here's a biography on him.
Brian Eno has traversed a lot of ground, from glam rock to the ambient music he commonly works in today, with producing being just another project he has been able to put under his belt along the way. His working has gone from David Bowie to Talking Heads to U2, but it all started in 1948 on the 15th of May, when a boy named Brian Peter George Eno was born in Woodbridge, Suffolk. He learned most of his basics at Ipswich Art School and the Winchester School of Art. He started dabbling in the use of recording devices as just another form of instrument, but was first recognized in his work with Roxy Music, where he was considered the keyboardist, but in concert could often be found working behind them all with a mix board and gadgets, where he was playing the right samples at the right time. He would often be governing the amount of volume of all the other musicians, and basically quietly running the show. This is where he first proclaimed himself a non-musician. He found himself working with David Bowie as a fellow writer and musician after parting with Roxy Music, and his assistance can be found on Bowie's acclaimed Berlin Trilogy. He also became, which can more or less be considered an invisible band member, of the Talking Heads for quite a number of their albums, in which he was so influential he may have been considered one of the guiding forces and lead members, but he did not appear on stage, and was credited simply as a producer most of the time. U2 became another producing gig for him, and he was the producer for both Unforgettable Fire and Achtung Baby. Brian Eno has also released a number of solo albums, which range from punk and post-punk, influenced largely by an experimental and free-floating energy Brian Eno takes around with him, to ambient albums that use basic sounds and everyday noises to convey a unanimous feeling of peace without being simple music at all, but filled with various layers and levels. Overall, despite the fact that Brian Eno considers himself a non-musician, he's been one of the most influential people in music through his work as a band member, a producer, and his newest popular title, The Father of Modern Ambient Music.
So what do you think of Brian Eno, Eric?
He's got a lot to him. Like, it's very multi-layered, and he has different styles, but he often, like, he started in, like, art rock and glam rock and stuff like that, and he moved to this, so he obviously covers tons of different areas and stuff like Another Green World and his ambient are totally different, but you can still see he's coming from the same place. So it's interesting to see him look at all these different places from the same perspective, personally. How about you?
Yeah. Well, I think he's really good because he's very ambient and his music is very delicate. He pays attention to detail.
How do you mean?
Well, like you said, it's very multi-layered. And how do you come up with multi-layered? You have to be delicate and precise, and like it's not popular music per se that's very entertaining, but it's very, you can tell he's put a lot of thought into it. And
it's really relaxation music. But if you...
In a way, not
but
really.
But if you listen to it carefully, you can come into a totally different place as well. Like, you can totally relax to it and just let it wash over you. And you can also, like, listen to it and you can find all the different, like, niches of it. Because it seems, like, very repetitive. Like, he's using the same beats over and over again just to, like, relax you or bring peace and stuff like that. But when you listen to it, there's, like...
When you listen to it, it's not... It's there's always something new that's going to draw you in again.
Right, well, and there's always, like, he maintains a certain wash of color or emotion. Like, it's not just a bunch of loops.
Yeah, it's not cheap crap.
Well, yeah, it's just...
Like, he spent a lot of time on it.
Exactly, like, he gives each thing, like, thoughts, it seems, and he gives care to each different moment that is in the song. No matter if it's repeating a moment that's already happened or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just, like, thrown together. It's really meditated on, almost.
Yeah, which is very good because, like, usually we're just running around doing stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like, usually we just run around doing stuff unconsciously. And Brian Eno really calls you to just sit down, listen to music. It's, like, sort of another way of life. Like, not, like, corny or anything, but it's just... calls you sort of into peaceful living, like not being so frantic.
Well, when you listen to him, you really have to think about what you're hearing because it's not...
Exactly. You can't just listen to it and just, like, listen to it just for kicks. Like, well, you have to actually get something from it, you have to sit down and concentrate on it.
Which yeah, is or a go good... to sleep to it.
Sure. Which is a good way to live, like, all the time. Like, not just... going for quick stuff, but actually sitting with things.
Well, I think with tons of music, you can always like sit with it.
Well, yeah,
and
of course.
Think about it, and like every single, I think not every single, but most good, like all good musicians,
yeah,
can when you listen to them meditatively, you get something different from them than when you listen to them, like just on the fly. But the thing with Brian Eno is that he almost calls you to listen
to them meditatively.
Exactly.
You can do that with any music, but Brian Eno, that's exactly the kind of music it is.
Well, it's just that Brian Eno, listening to him on the fly, it just wouldn't be as interesting.
Exactly.
But, like, to find the actual interest and the underlying, like, moments that make it good music, you have to sit with it and, like,
exactly. To actually get something out of it, you have to sit with it.
Exactly.
So, which is very good because it's not what we usually do.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
And it is the better thing to do.
Yeah, I think his album Ambient 2, or is that Ambient 1? Ambient 1, Music for Airports. That was a really good album for that because it like
yes.
If you don't listen if you don't listen to it, totally taking it on and thinking about it, it seems like
it's very repetitive
going on. But when you listen to it, it's so like you get into a whole mood that he gives you, and like you even move to it. Like I found like I was just listening to it, and like I was like. My whole body seemed like it was like the heart was beating to it and stuff like that. It was a really interesting thing. Like you totally entered the music, like just let it kind of take over. That was probably my favorite album of his. Although Another Green World, which is when he was still doing punk stuff, but doing his own kind of rendition on punk.
Punk stuff?
Yeah.
What do you mean punk stuff?
Punk music.
Oh yeah.
Another Green World, that was very interesting for that. Like, he kept singing with it, and, he kept, like, kind of almost, like, rock guitars in certain songs, especially the first song is like that. It kind of just starts, like, you hear this big, strong guitar. Anyway, it's, the way he worked with that in there, too, was really interesting to listen to, just to see kind of almost an evolution that he had gone through.
Yeah. I thought it's very cosmic music.
How do you
mean? Like it's sort of like you typically think of the stars as very peaceful, you know? Like because it's sort of outside of Earth.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
And like so I thought like it could work well in like a space documentary. So if you ever worked on a space documentary, you could use it.
Huh, yeah. That would be pretty cool to like I can see what you're saying, like it's totally it seems very otherworldly, the music.
It is.
Very, like it's kind of like it's from space or something like that. Like it moves almost like it's a heartbeat of an Earth or mm-hmm. of a planet or something like that, as opposed to being just a song that a guy made.
Yeah.
Like it's very...
It's not... Yeah, exactly.
It seems like it's more than just what this guy
mm-hmm.
made.
Yeah. Well, all good music is that.
Yeah, but like it's
it definitely seems yeah
because it's well it just seems so
ambiguous.
No, not Earth like it's from nature like it because it moves with like
it doesn't feel like it's something it doesn't seem like it's something that we made
right
Brian Eno made.
It's very organic, like it's very it flows very very easily.
Yeah,
like, as opposed to something that was made with man-made things and stuff like that, it seems like it's very much it kind of like came out of like something higher or it came
yeah.
out of the he's around his environment around and stuff like that, like it's
yeah
it
the noises grew. Resemble the everyday,
right? Like it grew as opposed to it was created like with guitars and drums and stuff like that.
Yeah, which is good. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very ambiguous.
How do you mean?
Like his music doesn't usually have like a typical song will have like a nice drums, nice guitar, big solo in the middle, right?
Okay.
But and it'll sort of decide everything for you, but it's good because like some songs will go into definite parts of the song, you know, it'll go into part A, part B, part C. Where Brian Eno, it's very ambiguous and it's not black and white. It's not like this part is this way, this part is that way. It's very ambiguous, you see what I'm saying?
Not really, no, sorry.
Like, a regular song will have a few parts to the song, very definitive parts. It'll have like a raging solo in the middle.
So it'll have like the chorus, the bridge, and the verse.
Yeah, and Brian Eno's songs are very ambiguous because they're...
Because they don't have a chorus or a bridge or a verse.
Yeah, it's not very... It's not fast. It's not instant.
But songs with choruses and bridges and verses don't have to be fast or instant.
Well, I know, but it's very, it doesn't decide everything for you.
Okay. Sorry, I don't... What do you
like
mean?
Like we were saying before, it's meditative music.
Okay, so, like, you have to listen to it more to get, like, the other layers, or what?
Yeah, exactly. The layers aren't apparent. Like, it's not black and white. Like, you don't see the layers instantly.
Well, even rock music isn't black and white, though.
I know, but I'm just saying that Brian Eno's music seems to be that way.
It's very explicitly ambiguous.
Yes.
Like, it's obviously not just Yeah, okay, I get what you're saying, yeah.
It shows you, it actually opens your eyes up to the world, actually. Because a lot of the noises, a lot of the sounds in his songs are sounds that resemble the everyday.
Okay.
Like, there'll be, like, birds chirping in some of his songs, right?
Yeah.
And it really makes you think about the sounds around you and how ignorant we are of them. You know? Like, it makes you think how much there is out there. Because a lot of his songs did come from what was just out there.
Okay, so like, in this way also, it's very cosmic. It's like showing what's out there, and there's so much more.
It's opening your eyes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds magnanimous. I'm off to listen to more Brian Eno.
Me too.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
That was Musings of the Living, Edition 21. We hope you enjoyed it.
And if you have any requests, suggestions, or comments, email us at musingsoftheliving@gmail.com. No spaces, no dashes, no underscores, no nothing. And here's an outro song.
So we're sitting in the base.